If you've been coming to church for a while, you'll know that our theme for this year is kingdoms. We're looking at the fact that we live in a world full of kingdoms and that there is a kingdom above the kingdoms, the kingdom of heaven. And that's what we're thinking about throughout this year. And the reality is that we live in a world of kingdoms, and the kingdoms of the world make this a dangerous place. Because you see, the kingdoms are not content to live side by side. One kingdom watches carefully what another does and seeks to undermine and disrupt it. And that means we get caught up in stuff that in one way we're not a part of, but another way we are, because we live among the kingdoms. There's been a lot of talk again in this last week or so about the damage done to British security by Russian spying operations in the 1940s and the 1950s. This is Kim Philby. Kim Philby was a graduate of Cambridge University and became an employee of the security services. But at the same time, he was also an employee of the Russian security services. And he recruited MacLean and Burgess, who were friends of his at Cambridge, along with a number of other people, and they became what is reckoned to be probably the most successful spying ring inside British security ever. They did a huge amount of damage, more damage than maybe can actually be calculated, so much so that so many years after this, we're long past the 40s and 50s now, we're still talking about the implications of what they did. Because one kingdom watches another, and people get caught up in this clash of kingdoms. And the reality is that the kingdom of heaven is clashing with every other kingdom in the world. And all people get caught up in this clash. And in the parable that we read a moment or two ago, Jesus deals with this issue. Over the next few weeks, Michael started this series last Sunday. Over the next few weeks, we're going to look at these kingdom tales, these stories Jesus told, parables we call them, that tell us about the kingdom. And there are a number of parables which begin with this statement. They all start like this. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like. And then there follows a story or an event or an individual who in some way models something which is true of the kingdom of heaven. We're going to look at some of these over the next few weeks. And the one before us today deals with this issue. It deals with the issue of the clash of kingdoms that's going on all around us that we're a part of, and especially the clash between the kingdom of heaven and all the other kingdoms of the world. It deals with that issue by telling an agricultural story. Now, that immediately puts me at a disadvantage because I don't know anything about agriculture. But you already know that anyway. William Archbold, more than anybody, already knows that. I know nothing about agriculture. However, the specific part of agriculture Jesus picked on in this parable is something every single one of you in this church know about. Because one of the biggest problems of the world is that weeds grow. Weeds grow. It's just the way Genesis said it would be. As a result of the fall of man, God says to Adam, you're going to earn your keep by the sweat of your brow, and the land that you have is going to produce thistles and thorns. You're going to have to work with that all your days. Weeds just grow. You don't even need to try. They're just there. And in the manse, we've got three lawns. Well, 6 months ago, it would have been hard to describe any of them technically as a lawn. Because I think one of the key requirements of a lawn is there has to be grass in it. And basically, if you looked at our lawns, they were terrible. And Christine had been saying to me for a while, John, I need to do something, but that's terrible. They look awful. They're dreadful. They were. So I don't know anything about this. Okay, I had tried various things, probably made it worse. So eventually, I rang up Green Thumb and said, can you come take a look at my lawn and see what needs to be done? And when they come, they do an assessment of your lawn, okay? And they give you this very nicely printed out sheet afterwards. And the sheet has a series of tick boxes on it where they tick the things that might be wrong with your lawn. In my case, every single box was ticked. Okay, I had weeds in the lawn. I had moss in the lawn. My lawn was infested with the larvae of crane flies. I don't even know what that is. And they basically said, your lawn's a total write-off, but we can fix it for a price. And of course, an assessment like that where all the boxes are ticked means the solution to the problem is more expensive than if they'd only had to tick one of the boxes. Now, 6 months later, my lawn has some grass. And they scarified it and did put holes in it. And I don't know why they do that. A while, just about 3 or 4 weeks ago, looked pretty grim after they did that. But thanks to the rain in the last few weeks, it actually looks green now. It's incredible. And the patches are beginning to cover over and it looks really good. Now, all that effort had to go into a lawn which just acquired weeds. They just grew. I didn't do anything to make them grow. Even my best efforts to stop them from growing didn't prevent it. They just grew. So what would it be like if somebody actually sowed weeds in your garden? I mean, they come without any help, but what would it be like if you actually went and sowed weeds in somebody's garden or somebody's field? And that's the story Jesus tells. He says, a farmer sows a field, but while he and his workers are sleeping and taking a rest, an enemy comes along and sows darnel in the field among the wheat seeds, and it's only discovered too late in the season to be removed, and it can only be dealt with at harvest. That's the story. So how is the kingdom above the kingdoms like that story? Well, we can trace the likeness between the story that Jesus tells and the kingdom of heaven in three elements of the story that come to the surface one at a time. So in each part of that story we read a few minutes ago, as you read through it, three different elements come up to the surface of the story and become significant. And as we look at each of those elements, we understand what Jesus was saying. We get to figure out what the comparison is between this agricultural tale and the kingdom above the kingdoms. And here's the first element, the enemy. The enemy. This scenario of one farmer sowing weeds in another farmer's field seems highly unlikely. I mean, how much do you have to hate somebody to do something like that? Where would you even get the weed seeds from? You know, like, what sort of a person would do that? It seems highly unlikely. Jesus is stretching belief here a little bit in this story. Well, probably not. Yeah, your iPad's really cool too. Yeah, it's actually probably better than mine. Enjoy. So anyway, Jesus tells us, do you think it's likely? Well, here's an interesting fact. The Roman Empire passed a law to prevent people from sowing poisonous plants in their neighbor's fields. And nobody passes a law unless there's a problem associated with it. So it looks like as if in Jesus' day, this was a common enough way to get back at somebody else. So when Jesus told the story, it wasn't that unusual, probably. And the story itself is made more shocking by the fact of the personal element. This is one neighbor against another. That's the farmer's conclusion. When he looks at his field, when his workers come in and tell him that the field's full of weeds, how could the field be full of weeds? This is what he says. He says, an enemy did this. And he did it by stealth, because the script says, while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. A parable doesn't criticize the landowner or the workers for sleeping. This was a day before mechanization, so all the work on the farm had to be done by hand, more or less, or by animals. When you finished your work at the end of the day, you were shot. And so at the end of the day, the workers and the landowner went to bed and they slept soundly. But that necessary refreshment and renewal that the workers and the landowner needed gave the opportunity to the enemy to destroy the crop. He uses that opportunity. So what does Jesus mean by this story about the enemy? Well, Jesus explains it later on. We didn't read it. Some verses later in the same chapter in Matthew, you have Jesus' explanation of the parable. And it says in verse 37, Jesus answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the people of the kingdom. The weeds are the people of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil." We are caught in a clash of kingdoms between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the evil one. The evil in the world in which we live is no accident. It's no accident. Of course, we know that human beings are capable of doing terrible things. History is littered right up to the present day with the crimes of human individuals. And we also know that human systems create injustice and bondage and are themselves responsible for the creation of evil in the world. But what we discover in the parable and what Jesus is teaching us is that all the evil in the world cannot be explained simply by human sinfulness and by the sinfulness of human institutions. You can't explain it just by that. It turns out that there is an enemy whose speciality this is. And sometimes in human behavior, you can see the telltale signs of his presence. During the week, Radio 5 Live was running a special series of stories on a particularly sensitive and horrible thing, which is FGM, female genital mutilation, which goes on in the world. They were doing that because right now in the United Kingdom, it's reckoned there are 62,000 young girls in danger of becoming the subject of this. And internationally, they reckon there's about 140 million women in the world who suffer the consequences of that right now in this generation. And so they've been running a series of stories on this during the week in Radio 5 Live. And I was in the car one day when this woman told her story. Her name probably isn't pronounced anything like this, but it's Hebo Wardere. She came originally from Somalia, but she lives in the UK. As a child of primary school age, I think about 8 years of age, she was taken by her mother and she was the subject of FGM. And she tells in a short clip, it's about 2 minutes long. Actually, the clip is on the Radio 5 Live website. You can go onto the website and click. You can listen to her story. Moving, heart-rending story. And in the story, she tells what it was like as a child to endure this procedure. I don't want to get into the details of it now. You can listen to it for yourself. But here's the interesting thing that she said in the story. She said that when she was taken to the place where this happened to her, she was there with her mother and her aunt and a number of other women. She was physically restrained. And in those circumstances, the cutter, the woman who was going to do this action on her, kneeled down before her. And she said, What I will never forget, I see it still when I close my eyes or I go to sleep at night. What I will never forget are her eyes. And this is what she said. It just looked like the devil's eyes. It just looked like the devil's eyes. Sometimes in human behavior, you see the marks of the enemy. Sin and darkness and evil in the world are not just explained by what human beings and human systems do. There is an enemy. That enemy cannot touch Jesus. He cannot touch Jesus. He killed him and he still didn't break him. He killed him and Jesus was raised from the dead and is alive forevermore. He cannot touch Jesus, but he can try and destroy whatever belongs to Jesus. The enemy works on a zero-sum strategy. See, the farmer that planted weeds in his neighbor's field, it didn't benefit the farmer. He wasn't going to get any more for his own crop because he destroyed his neighbor's crop. But he was working on a zero-sum strategy. And the zero-sum strategy says, if my enemy is blessed, then I'm impoverished. But if my enemy is impoverished, I am blessed. It's a farce. It's nonsense, of course. But that's what a zero-sum strategy means. That's the devil's strategy. It's the only strategy he has. He cannot touch Jesus. He cannot destroy the kingdom. But he reckons that if by some means or another he can destroy or he can impoverish the kingdom of God's people, then somehow or another he enriches himself. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? It's the strategy that the two communities in Ireland have lived with for over 400 years. And it's the devil's strategy. It's the enemy's strategy. The only strategy he has, zero sum. You can see the marks of his presence all around us, all the time. And if you enter the kingdom above the kingdoms, you are a part of this titanic struggle. And that enemy is your enemy. There is an enemy. Parable then goes on to feature the wheat. So the enemy cannot touch King Jesus. He can only damage what is his. The enemy cannot enrich himself at his neighbor's expense, the only thing he can do is destroy his neighbor's crop. The only thing where Jesus can be touched is in what belongs to him. And of course, that's the world, belongs to him. So in the parable, that's the field. And so that's where the enemy strikes. It says in verse 25, but while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. Weeds among the wheat. That's the reality of our lives if we follow Christ. Every day of our lives and every situation and circumstance in which we find ourselves, there are weeds among the wheat. There are us who belong to the kingdom of heaven, and there are those who belong to the kingdom of the enemy. And the problem is that sometimes it is almost impossible in the world to tell the difference between the two. Does anybody else at work follow Jesus Christ? How would you know? Anybody else in some of the other situations to which you relate day by day? Are they followers of Jesus Christ or not? How would you know? Sometimes it's hard to tell because the two look uncannily the same. That's true of Jesus' parable. Because the weeds that are sown by the enemy are not just any old weeds. The plant the enemy sows is the darnel, the Lolium temulentum. You impressed? That's Latin. Okay, I Googled it. All right. So, okay, and here it is. On the left-hand side is wheat. On the left-hand side is darnel. The darnel is a rye grass. Essentially, it's a bastard wheat. And basically, it looks virtually identical to the wheat. Until later in the season, that is. And that's why the parable says this. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. What did that mean? What it means is this. The two plants were virtually indistinguishable in the early part of the season. But when it came later in the season and the heads began to form on the top of the plant, the ears began to form and you could see the ears, then you could tell which was the darnel and which was the wheat because the ears of the darnel plant were black. And so then you could understand that the problem was that you couldn't tell right away. It wasn't always possible to say, have I got weeds in my field or have I not? And it's similarly so in the world. One of the frustrating difficulties is loads of people who look like they're Christians very often turn out not to be. Loads of people who look like they're not very often turn out to be. The problem with the darnel is, because it was sown, didn't just blow in on the wind or get dropped by birds, it would be prolific among the wheat. And because it was so similar to the wheat, it was not removed in the springtime when the fields were weeded. So it was left there to grow. Furthermore, apparently wet weather promotes its growth and also encourages the growth on the darnel of a fungus which is poisonous to the wheat. The situation in the field was serious. And the workers recognized this and they came to the landowner with the issue. They realized things were bad. The servants asked him, do you want us to go and pull them up? That was their immediate reaction. It was kind of the obvious reaction in a way. They said, look, this is serious. This was serious for the workers as much as it was serious for the farmer because these people were as dependent on that harvest for their own livelihoods as the farmer was. He said, well, what are we going to do? But notice something. The wheat was still standing among the weeds at the end of the season and against all the odds. The wheat persevered. The attempts of the neighboring farmer to destroy the wheat by planting the weeds was unsuccessful. The wheat stood till the harvest. There's something about the life of God when it enters a human life that cannot be destroyed. We should know that. Because the letter to the Hebrews tells us about the nature of Jesus' status. This is what it says. It says, Jesus has become a priest, not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of the power of an indestructible life. Something about the life of Jesus that cannot be destroyed. And when that life, by faith in him and through the presence of the Holy Spirit, inhabits our lives, something comes into our lives that cannot be destroyed. John writes to encourage some young Christians in his first letter who find themselves in the midst of false prophets. And he says to them, "You dear children are from God and have overcome them because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world." Do you believe that? Do you believe that the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world, no matter what the odds look like? There was an incredible story in yesterday's Belfast Telegraph of Jane Stewart. I don't know, some of you may have read the story. It's a moving story. Actually, really interestingly, if you go to the Belfast Telegraph website, her testimony in her home church in Bangor Elim is there. There's a link to it above all places on the Belfast Telegraph website. It's almost unbelievable, but it's there. You can click on it, you can listen to her tell her own story in her own church. But if you read the story, you'll know that she grew up at home. She was one of four children. She grew up at home with her mum and dad. Her dad was a police officer. Her mum also had been a police officer earlier in life, but later in life, had after she got married and had children, had given that job up, was doing another job. And throughout the totality of her mum and dad's marriage, her father was a violent and an abusive man. And at various stages along the way, members of the family had pleaded with their mum to leave home, to get out of the house for her own safety. She always refused to do it. And eventually, when Jane was 16 or 17, she realized that her own life was now in danger because of her father's behavior. And so she said she was going to leave home. And for one last time, she said to her mum, "Please, would you not come with me?" And finally, her mum agreed to go. By some means or other, her dad found out about it. Her dad went to pick her up from work one day, brought her home. And after he brought her home to their house, shot her mum dead with his issue gun and then shot himself. She came home from school to find both her parents dead at home. Horrendous story. And she entered a pretty bad time in her life after that. She descended into drugs and other things, self-destructive behavior. But eventually her life turned around. And the story is a positive story because it tells a story of how she came finally to faith in Jesus Christ and how her life was transformed and how eventually she has come to a point where she has forgiven her dad. It's an incredible story. You need to read it. How did her mom cope? The interesting thing about the story is that she says that through the years of the abusive and violent relationship which she had with her husband, she gained strength to continue through her faith in God. She kept her wedding vows. She continued to live as she lived because she trusted Jesus Christ and she received power from him, the power of an indestructible life. She was the wheat that stood to the harvest. Right to the end of her earthly life, she stood because of the power of Christ in her life. And her daughter said the following thing about her own conversion. She said this: "God promises us that he will bring good out of everything, and he did. My mom is rejoicing in heaven because her four kids, against all the odds, are going to be joining her there one day. And that's all because of Jesus. The wheat stood till the harvest." That's the truth of what Jesus is saying. Do you believe that? The one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. That in Jesus is the power of an indestructible life. And if you invite him into your life, you're inviting in an indestructible power. We are not called to hide away from the world, to live a monastic existence in the safety of some sealed community where the world can never touch us, because we're afraid that if the world touches us, that the darnel will destroy the wheat. The wheat stood to the harvest. God calls us to stand like the wheat to the harvest day by the life of God flowing in us and through us. There is an enemy. And then there is the wheat. And finally, the farmer. The workers come to the farmer distraught. They look at the state of the field. They think about themselves and their own families and how they're going to survive if the harvest fails. And they say to the master, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" It seems the obvious thing to do. It's going to take an age to do because the field is full of standing grain. It's going to be very difficult to do this without doing serious damage. They realize they're out on a job that is practically impossible, but they don't see what else they can do. And they come to the landowner and they get a strange response, because the landowner is not fazed at all by the developments in his field. We read, "No," he answered, "because while you're pulling the weeds, you may uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn." See, to understand why the farmer wasn't fazed by this, you need to see the field the way the farmer sees it. Because the farmer doesn't see a field the way I see a field, maybe the way most of you see a field. You go out in your car, September time of year, you drive through the countryside, the fields are full of golden grain, you think, oh, isn't that beautiful? Or maybe they're full of some of those other plants, that plant that has the glorious yellow flower that fills the whole countryside with amazing yellow color, and you think, wow, that's amazing. The farmer looks at the field, he doesn't see that. Well, I'm sure he sees that, but that's not the first thing on his mind. And whenever the servants looked at the field, okay, to the untrained eye, the darnel looks a sight. And here it was black heads all over the field. There was so much of it because it was sown. It didn't get there by accident. And not only is it a sight, but it's a threat, and it should be removed. But the appearance of the field is not the focus of the farmer. His focus would be the harvest. His focus was on the harvest, not on what the field looked like now. To uproot the weeds at this point would be to risk destroying the wheat too, because the two are entangled together. So his strategy is to wait. To wait. And this is truly one of the most annoying things about God. Isn't it? Because we want the judgment now. We want the weeds pulled up now. We want that obnoxious person dealt with. We want all the injustice and the darkness of the world brought to an end. We want the weeds pulled up now. Why did God not do something before Chris Harper Mercer opened fire on the pupils at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon, on the first of this month, killing all those kids? Why did God not do something now? New York Post reported, quote, "A gunman singled out Christians, telling them they would see God in 1 second during a rampage at Oregon College Thursday that left at least 9 innocent people dead and several more wounded, survivors and authorities said." And then here's a quote from a woman whose daughter was wounded in the shooting. She says, "He started asking people one by one what their religion was. Are you a Christian? He would ask them. And if you're a Christian, stand up. And they would stand up. And he said, good, because you're a Christian, you're going to see God in just about 1 second, and then he shot and killed him. Why did God not do something before he did that? But he waited. And he still waits. And there are people sitting in this building today that are so glad God waits. Because if God had decided 5 years ago to bring human history to a close and to deal with all that is sinful and wicked and despicable about it, then you would have been on the wrong side of the line 5 years ago. You would have been on the wrong side of the line 1 year ago. You would have been on the wrong side of the line 4 weeks ago. And you have reason to be thankful to God today that God's strategy is to wait. God's strategy is to wait. And because he waits, the harvest is bigger. The righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. See, for reasons I cannot know now, God, the farmer, waits. And he does so even though I and loads of other people want to cry out on different days, "Lord, why do you not come now and bring this to an end? Why do you not stop this now?" for reasons I do not know and I cannot know right now, he waits. And because he waits, the ultimate result at harvest will be greater than it otherwise could have been. And we should thank him right now. We should thank him because of that spouse, because of that child, because of that parent or friend or colleague at work who right now doesn't know Jesus and who needs the Lord to wait just a little bit longer so that that prayer could be answered. The farmer has a strategy. Loads of times the strategy doesn't make sense, but the farmer's eye isn't on what my eye is on. The farmer's eye is on the harvest. The farmer's eye is on a kingdom that will be so large that the membership of it cannot be counted by the human eye. And for that ultimate purpose, he waits. And right here, right now, he's waiting for some people that might actually be sitting in this church or that you might be going back to share lunch with in a few minutes' time. He is waiting and waiting. Because although the darnel cannot be changed into wheat, the members of the kingdom of darkness can become members of the kingdom of light. How is the kingdom above the kingdoms like the story Jesus tells? Kingdom above the kingdoms is like that story because there is an enemy. We are caught up in a titanic struggle of which the whole of creation is a part, between the kingdom of heaven and every other kingdom that exists. And if we are members of the kingdom of heaven, then we have an enemy and he's serious. And the stories tell us something about the kingdom of heaven because of the wheat. Because when we come to trust in Jesus Christ, God puts into our lives the power of an indestructible life. And he who is in me is greater than he who is in the world. And I'm going seeking strength from him to still be standing at the end. And there is a farmer whose view is much bigger than mine, who understands agriculture in a way that I don't, and who, for reasons I cannot know right now, is giving time, a little more time, for you.